this week's program, The Letters of Louis MacNeice, selected and edited by Jonathan Allison. Among MacNeice's most regular correspondence were the classical scholar E.R. Dodds, the art historian Anthony Blunt, and the poet T.S. Eliot. There are numerous letters to his two wives, but his most animated and passionate correspondence was with an American writer, Eleanor Clark, who married the poet Robert Penn Warren. MacNeice was born in 1907 and died in 1963. With me, Derek Hand, who teaches in the English department in St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra. He's writing a history of the Irish novel for Cambridge University Press. Colin Graham of the English department at Maynooth is author of Deconstructing Ireland and Irish and Postcolonial Writing. Eve Patton is senior lecturer in English and head of discipline for the School of English at Trinity College, Dublin. She has a particular interest in 19th century and 20th century Irish studies. Here's Louis MacNeice reading his own poem, Carrickfergus.
Carrickfergus. I was born in Belfast between the mountain and the gantries, to the hooting of lost sirens and the clang of trams, thence to smoky Carrick in County Antrim, where the bottleneck harbour collects the mud which jams the little boats beneath the Norman castle, the piers shining with lumps of crystal salt. The Scotch quarter was a line of residential houses, but the Irish quarter was a slum for the blind and halt. The brook ran yellow from the factory, stinking of chlorine. The yarn mill called its funeral cry at noon. Our lights looked over the loch to the lights of Bangor under the peacock aura of a drowning moon.
Louis MacNeice reading his own poem, Carrickfergus. Derek.
I think we'll get a lot of senses of different places of these letters. And Carrickfergus, I think, is from mostly from the child's view. So it's restrictive, it's limited from that sort of child perspective. And then on returns to Ireland, he always seems to be, well, rushing somewhere else. He's like a tourist, I think. But that's not just in Ireland, I think that's everywhere. Mm. It sort of struck me, there's a certain disconnectedness in his life. He has lots of addresses. He travels a lot within Britain, within Ireland and the world when he goes to India and these various places later in his life. But it's a sense of capturing, I think, that sense of the 20th century sense of disconnection from a place, a final place that he could sort of find rest and solace and a sense of comfort.
Eve, what kind of person emerged for you in the letters overall?
Well, I think some readers of MacNeice's poetry tend to regard him as quite a cold and controlled poet. And when you read the letters, it's quite the opposite. You see a man who's much warmer in his letters, and much more inconsistent and occasionally lacking in control. So I think he's quite engaging in the letters, and we're allowed to see a man who makes mistakes, which he so rarely does in his poetry. Having said that, I think that it's very difficult to construct a full life from these letters. We know a lot about MacNeice, obviously, from his own autobiographical writings, from Autumn Journal or from The Strings of False. And if you just come to the letters, they're so full of gaps and silences and missing people and correspondents who simply aren't there because he was with them all the time. So you get fragments of a life with particular emphases and bearings that aren't quite the same as what we might get in a narrative biography or autobiography.
Let me hear you on the letters, Colin Graham.
I suppose one of the things that came across for me was partly how hard this man worked all his life and how hard he tried to be a writer. And particularly in the 1930s, we see him trying to develop a kind of professionalism and struggling, in a sense, to find his mood. And he tries out all kinds of different moods. And that's one of the most interesting things that comes across in the letters, that he's writing all the time. Mm. He's doing lectures, he's writing prose books, he's writing criticism, and he's writing his poetry at the same time. And one of the most striking things is a kind of self-consciousness that comes across in that professional life. He first mentions the fact that he's writing his autobiography in 1934, which becomes The Strings Are False. It's promised again and again to publishers throughout the letters, and it doesn't appear until after he dies, and even then it's unfinished. And in a way, I think that's symbolic of MacNeice as a character, is that he was... The best thing about MacNeice is that he was unfinished. The best poems that he writes are those which are never quite complete, in which he never comes to a conclusion, in which everything is still moving, changing, and that's when he's at his most interesting. At the historical moments that are most interesting in the book are the moments of absolute historical change, the beginning of the Second World War and the partition of India, which he witnesses.
He was working for the BBC there.
He was working for the BBC in 1947.
He died just under 50 years ago, Derek. Has there been a kind of trajectory to the course of the reputation? I mean, did he, you know, was he, has it been high and dipped, or has it been on an even keel?
Well, I think as Colin points out, I think a lot of his writing in his life is based upon him being there. The energy sort of comes from that, because he is the professional writer. While he's a poet, he's doing all these other things, travel writing, prose writing, and so on, then writing these plays and pieces for the BBC, which he seemed to be very good at, actually. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense in which his reputation in his own lifetime is based upon his presence, as it were. Mm-hmm. I think after his death, I think he's always been sort of seen as a kind of marginal hanger-on figure to the Audens and the Spenders and so on, in a way that Elizabeth Bowen is sort of seen as, you know, good, but not quite as good as Virginia Woolf, etc., which is probably unfair. And then I think in the last number of years, 30, 40 years, from the 70s onwards, late 60s, 70s onwards, an attempt to sort of reimagine him, but it's not even reimagine him, but to sort of consider him as an Irish writer, who has something to sort of say about our dilemmas and difficulties. And certainly, I mean, you could sort of read the various masks and the emerging of a personality. And he's so conscious of that. He's conscious of that from the first school he goes to, of being Irish. And it's something that is always there. And what I found interesting, sort of just reading the letters, in a very offhand, casual way, he lists all these people he knows. In one of those sort of late letters from the 50s, he's talking about coming over for a rugby match, which I think we lost at that stage. you know, and he's listing off all these various writers and people and so on that had, you know, had not been mentioned in any of the other letters. So he was very clued into what was sort of happening. Hmm. I mean, he talked about actually Austin Clark, you know, a forgotten poet, Patrick Kavanagh, not so forgotten poet, but you know, he had he had a good sense of their position.
Eve Patton, do you agree that he was overshadowed by the others, by Auden and so on?
I don't think so at all. It's very interesting that Auden is one of the writers who doesn't emerge clearly at all from the letters. There's very little written to Auden in the letters, and yet we know how significant he was as a bearing for McNeice in real life. If you were just to go on the evidence of the letters, you'd look to Anthony Blunt as such an influence and someone to whom McNeice at Oxford and indeed afterwards and before at Marlborough showed off in a kind of flamboyant and decadent way. One of the poses or the masks that Derek was mentioning was really geared towards impressing Blunt. And you forget that Blunt himself was so intellectually sophisticated and so aware of not only literature but art, of course, which McNeice also had an interest in, that you see alongside Auden other influences coming through the letters that you might not perhaps have noted. I think one of the interesting early letters for me, or two early letters for me, which were very striking, were where McNeice talks about having read Virginia Woolf. Now, Virginia Woolf really disappears from his field of vision, but in around 1927, after he'd been reading her novels Mrs. Dalloway and To the Lighthouse, he sees in her, I think, something that he himself would like to do, which is to transform the commonplace, to celebrate the ordinary. And these are the kind of forgotten influences that slip away and can be retrieved through the letters.
Can I just ask Colin Graham about his reputation since his death?
Well, I suppose he was overshadowed in a way by the 1930s poets. And the period after his death and after the war, there was a kind of recuperation of the 1930s poets that went on by Marxist critics, some of whom like Margot Heinemann, who were witnesses to the time, and noted McNeice's scepticism and were looking for a kind of orthodoxy, in a sense, out of those poets, a kind of Marxist left-wing orthodoxy.
And he spoiled the party.
Well, he did in a way, but I think it's impossible to find in any of them when you look hard.
A party line.
Absolutely, yeah. And their I don't think, I mean, there were the worst of the 1930s poems are the best Marxist poems.
Can I just take, just a letter, you mentioned Auden, there's a letter to Auden I've been taking a note of here, in 1939 from Keats's Grove. He says, it's one in the eye for Bloomsbury, he says to Auden, that you discharged into poetry the subject matters of psychoanalysis, politics and economics. Mr. Eliot brought back ideas into poetry, but he uses the ideas, say, of anthropology, more academically and less humanly than you use Marx or Grodek. This is because you're always taking sides. It may be bad to take sides, but it's more vital than the detachment of the pure aesthete. That's one of the few letters. He also says that he's doubtful about Auden's use of the ballad form. He says, I hope you will start writing down to the crowd. Do you remember that letter?
What
do you
one of the things that? About that letter is yes. that it's written for publication.
Yeah.
It's not a personal letter. And the rhetoric of that is very much about positioning Auden in such a way that Auden is a major figure, but also so that McNeice can distinguish himself a little bit from Auden in print and make himself a distinctive figure. Most of Auden's correspondence was either destroyed or suppressed because Auden wished it to be after his death, not used as part of the biographies. And that's why Auden doesn't appear as a figure in the correspondence.
He says to Auden again, whatever the shape of your work, it will always have ideas in it. I suppose that's fair enough.
Mm. I think it's what Eve sort of said, that the usual sort of view of McNeice is that he's cold, distant and detached. And there's some wonderful letters to Eleanor Clark. I mean, these are really quite brilliant in terms of, you know, a relationship.
Yes,
there's a sense in which the mask
sort
of slips here. Darlings, oh my darling, and so on. And I can imagine if you're on, you know, 3 or 4 weeks on a boat, that suddenly these, you know, writing letters becomes something to do. But he attacks her at one stage because she's obviously attacked him for being detached and aloof and cold, etc. And he gives this wonderful kind of explanation of, look, I've done that. As a child, I empathised too much with all these other children and so on and so forth. So I've built this kind of identity that allows me to sort of exist and continue to exist and so on. But he himself, in a very passionate way, dismisses that charge, which I think is interesting and maybe is an insight into the poetry in terms of what poetry or any art does in terms of containment. You know, that it's about taking what is raw and immediate and giving it kind of shape and coherence so that it is, one, communicable and that it might sort of last. And he's very aware of that.
Let me read just on one of the letters to Clark, where he's really annoyed. It's 21st of May, 1940. I'm really angry with you. Instead of being merely upset, what in the hell do you mean by telling me that I have an awful lack of curiosity about the world? I was curious about the world and suffering from my curiosity about it before you were born. And if you think you can judge my curiosity about the world by the fact that I don't look at newspapers when you're around, show an appalling lack of feminine imagination, apart from which newspapers aren't the world anyway. So he's really irritated, unless he's, you know, hamming it up, but he seems to be quite annoyed there.
And there are a few things going on there. Clark was, in a way, a very committed Marxist. And he's very unsettled.
So that's what's going on there, is it?
It's partly that he feels challenged by her Marxism, and that links back to that challenge that he felt by looking at people like Auden and Spender and their commitment. So part of that is in there, but there's also in there as well a throwback for him at moments of anger. He is thrown back to his childhood. It happens in a letter to his first wife as well. At moments of extreme stress, or it's actually a letter to John Hilton writing about his separation from his first wife.
But she really got him, though. You know, he says, you know, as for looking at books off my field, I'm no Whiston or Aldous Huxley, and don't value information for information's sake, but you obviously have no knowledge of the sort of books I do look at and why. Yeah. It's quite childish there, isn't it, in tone? Yeah.
It's childish, but you have to remember how much he'd been bowled over by meeting this woman. I mean, the letter that Derek refers to, where he's travelling back from America, having met her, having fallen desperately in love, is something like, I think, 24 pages in manuscript. And it's this beautiful novella, almost, of life on board the ship, where he's writing passionately and with all the frustration to her about how he feels, and interspersing it with these comments on how the war is coming and what kind of attitude should he show towards it, and then noticing what people on board ship are doing or what someone told him in the bar the night before. It's quite an extraordinary letter.
Did she unhinge him in a way that other women didn't?
Yes. Mm. I think this is the defining relationship because, as Colin says, it challenged him politically, and he had to recognise that this was a woman who had her own political stance. And this didn't happen with the other relationships in his life to anything like that extent. And, of course, she was a writer too. And I think that was also a moment when he had to see her as an equal and on a par, and someone who couldn't simply be fitted into to his programme.
And that moment's also intertwined with the beginning of the war. So not only is he making a decision about how he's going to be in love with this woman, he's also trying to make a decision about whether to be in America or in England. And one of the interesting things that happens in that letter is, to resolve all of this, he reverts to Ireland. He reverts to his Irishness. He talks about how he is a peasant, and she doesn't understand this. And what he does there is to revert to the idea of himself as an Irish peasant, which is kind of farcical in a way.
Let me just read that letter. If you want a formula for me, it's that I'm a peasant who has gate-crashed culture. And when I say that I'm a peasant, this isn't a figure of speech or an inverted snob romanticism. It's just a statement of fact. She's upper class, and in dealing with the slum dweller would appear sympathetic, whereas he in the same situation would appear cold but actually would identify much more with the slum dweller. So he's saying this being a peasant gives him an advantage. You know, you may be a fancy Marxist theorist, but really, in a way, I know these people, I can identify with them more. Isn't this a kind of,
and that's an exaggeration, but it's an exaggeration that comes out of the moment. And it's one of the things that happens during the war with him as well, is that he imagines Ireland, he imagines his childhood as this alternative space, and he does that in quite a critical way. Here it's less critical because of the kind of fury, but also the tempestuousness of the moment, because he's in England, she's in America, the war is beginning, he's not sure what to do, he's not sure where he's meant to be, where's the right place to be, what are the right decisions to make, and on what basis to make them.
I think it's one of the points as well at which we do see the shadow of Yeats. And of course, McNeice was writing about Yeats as war broke out and had had him very much on his mind. And he has an ambivalent relationship to Yeats all the way through his earlier years. At times, he's quite dismissive. But you can
see,
he
wrote a book about him, didn't he?
Of course he did,
he's writing it as he's writing it.
He was writing it at this time. And I think he possibly associated this sense of a Yeatsian escape to the peasant world at this point, even though he knew it was a fantasy, even though he recognised it had no basis in reality, with everything that he'd been reading about Yeats,
stories about Yeats from Gogarty and Higgins, remember that?
Yeah.
He said when Yeats, a Spanish doctor, wrote an account of his health to Gogarty, which Gogarty read out, knowing Yeats wouldn't know what it meant, this is an antique sclerocardiac. And Yeats stopped him and rolled the word on his tongue and said, sclerocardiac. I'd rather have that title than be king of Lesser Egypt. It's really beautiful, isn't it? And you can imagine that. That rings true, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. Yeats saying, sclerocardiac.
I think that moment is interesting. For me, when you read this kind of text, I suppose it's after the fact. We all know the positions about the war and what happened in the war and so on. But McNeice is captured here because it hasn't happened yet. And he's trying to have a position on it, should I be for this? Should I be against it? And it does take about 2 or 3 years into the war, I think, that he suddenly, I'm actually, I'm behind the war effort, intellectually as well as sort of practically. But I found that kind of fascinating, that I suppose after the fact we think that everybody makes a decision in 1939 that is not the case.
Not at all. And I think it's terrific that the letters let us see how frightened he was, even during the periods when he was in London during the Blitz, and literally he was writing with either the threat or the reality of bombs falling on London, that he's very frightened at that period.
Do you remember that letter to Mary where he says, his wife Mary, I don't think I shall become actively political, but I do tend now to sympathise with the communists. Even old Anthony, that's Anthony Blunt, has gone Marxist, only I don't believe in bloody revolution. There's a kind of fascist movement even in the Irish Free State now. I just have a slight awakening of conscience that one ought to do something to try to stem all these bloody things happening in the world and not just lead a pretty little private life like any old Bloomsbury pansy. So this was at him all the time, the sense to which he... whether he was putting himself on the line or not.
He writes some poems about the war, which suggest he was able to take a stance which was either one of political certainty or of compassion. For example, the way he writes in the poem Refugees about the situation of European Jews suggests that he had a deep sympathy and consideration for their plight. When you look at the letters, you see a much more ambivalent MacNeice, concerned with how on earth Jewish refugees are to be assimilated into the instability of the wartime landscape, and he's much less compassionate towards them. And this is the kind of fault line you see between the letters and the finished poetry, which I think is really very interesting around the wartime period.
He never got that Trinity job, did he?
No, he didn't get the Trinity job. No, yeah. And he never really seemed to think that he was going to.
Yeah,
either. It was a bit of a long shot.
He has a line there. It was, the Trinity College appointment is taking longer than I thought. Living in error reminds one that people are by no means exclusively governed by economic factors. It was the communists in Spain who got things done, and not the anarchists. But the anarchists had got hold of something which the CP is just dumb about: more things in heaven and earth. Yes, so at least there's something to be said for the easygoing Irish.
When he applied for the Trinity job, he was quite concerned, as he puts it in one letter, that he didn't really know much about English literature. But fortunately, Walter Starkey assured him that this wouldn't be a problem. I can assure you it's not true.
But you get these wonderful little snippets. He talks about sort of the Irish sort of literary scene, you know, bitter, twisted, you know, they hate each other more than they hate poets from other places.
When he does travel, and of course he spent time in India for the BBC, and also of course when he was posted to Greece, to Athens, with the British Council in the 1950s, I do think that the letters from those periods are so much more self-conscious, and they're written to be kept. They're written as diary documentations, or they're written for a professional purpose. And in many ways, they should be more interesting for that, but I found them less absorbing.
What do you think when he writes about, well, you know, one of the totemic poems, Snow? He writes to Miss J. Freeman, I'm puzzled as to why people find it difficult, perhaps because they excavated for possible symbolism. In fact, it's a piece of factual reporting. In metaphysical language, the theme is plurality. What excited me was the sudden awareness that all these things were going on at the same time in the world. Is there much overall on the work, explicating stuff? Is there,
not really, no. I mean, and critics have used whatever has been available in terms of their criticism of MacNeice up to this point. I mean, there are comments on Autumn Journal in terms of what it might be about, little snippets here and there. But in many ways, he's not dealing with the poetry in that kind of way. That was just the one poem, letter that actually kind of dealt with a possible meaning or interpretation or reading of a poem.
I think she may have written to him, actually.
Yes, to probably ask
for explanation.
But I mean, it goes back to Colin sort of saying, like, the sheer hard work and intensity of the act of writing itself.
Did you pick up on that too, Eve? What both of your colleagues have been saying there. There's very much the sense here of the professional writer.
Absolutely,
through his life. Yes.
Absolutely. And I think one of the letters which struck me was from back in 1927, where he writes about how he's been attempting novels. And of course, he did attempt novels in the beginning, and how he thinks he might even give up writing verse because he realizes that his techniques in verse are beginning to collide with his techniques in writing novels. And it's a very interesting letter which really gives you a clue to how MacNeice became a journalistic poet. And I mean journalistic in a very positive sense, but a poet who could write about the everyday, the quotidian, the diurnal, the mundane when necessary. So there are some comments as he
moves. I smile when you say, and I mean journalistic in the nicest possible way.
Trying to head off the sense that might be a criticism.
No, I'm kidding. There's just a point, Eve, that Derek was talking about his knowledge of what's going on the literary scene, and Clark and Kavanagh. Also more widely, I mean, there's a letter to Corinna in 61 from the BBC, I think. I read a piece in the paper about Tony O'Reilly's engagement. I gather he now has a job in Cork. That's when he went to work for Sutton. So that would indicate that he was keeping his finger in a lot of pies, Derek.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it what comes across is, and I mean, that's why the charge of he's not reading the newspapers in the 1940s and
yes,
so on.
Yep.
I mean, you know, his antennae are out, he's picking up on things. It's remarkable again and again when he talks about certain people. You know, he knows these people, he knows their positions of power. I mean, one thing that sort of strikes me is that throughout the letters and over a lifetime, the idea of meeting all these old people from Marlborough who were in school with him or a year ahead of him or afterwards, the same in terms of his Oxford years. And also, the Irish are everywhere. He seems, you know, there's this drunk woman in India. You know, they just sort of crop up here and there.
And also, he's very keen when he's asked a lot to subscribe to journals on Irish issues and themes. He's very willing and keen to do it.
I don't think he ever sort of denied that was who he is and where he sort of came from.
But there's never been a suggestion of that.
But I think, you know, there's a sense, I think, himself probably that he felt that people, not that they didn't think that he was, but ignored it or sort of didn't deal with it and so on. Yeah. But I think his own sense of who he was is very much bound up in places like Carrickfergus, the west of Ireland, Sligo, Galway. I mean, you know, he really gets excited. That's one of the moments, certainly in the later poems, when he talks about going down to Galway to be with Richard Murphy like that. He really, there's a certain real.
I'm always hesitant about the major minor mode levels of characterization, but where do you place him, Colin?
I think it's very difficult to decide major, minor, and what's in between. When he's at his best, he's as good as anyone in the 20th century. The general critical opinion is that the 1950s and the late 1940s were a fallow period. And the letters, one of the things they illuminate, I suppose, is how hard he was working for the BBC during that period. Yeah. And perhaps that's an explanation of why that period isn't so good. What the letters also show you is that the 1930s, and particularly the late 1930s, is a period of extraordinary activity.
Eve, the question of the quality.
Major for me. I think anyone who can write Autumn Journal, a poem which tells us the very, very far reaches that poetry can get to in simply comprehending and assimilating and presenting a life, I think it's an extraordinary achievement. And it carries through and carries over the weaker decades that Colin's referring to.
Finally, Derek.
I would agree that somebody who can produce Autumn Journal has to be considered a major writer. I think perhaps it's, and this is what emerges, I think, from the letters, that it is in that sort of 20s and 30s that he's creating a sense of himself. Everything is fluid. There's whole potential and possibility. Perhaps, you know, the 30s and 40s, and he does work very hard for the BBC, there's a sense in which that he has created a persona. And maybe that sort of takes away a certain conflict or energy or dynamic within himself as a poet. But it's the achieving or the desire to create that sense of self that perhaps has its fullest expression in Autumn Journal.
We've been discussing Letters of Louis MacNeice, selected and edited by Jonathan Ellis and published by Fable. My thanks to Derek Hand, Colin Graham and Eve Patton. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.